Reed decided to present oral argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are ready to hear oral argument from petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Carlo Sprouse will present argument for petitioner.
As respondent said in its first brief filed in this court on page 1, the petitioner seeks review of the judgment of the Court of Appeals, and I quote, enforcing the indemnity provisions of a drilling contract. And on page 2, the respondent said, this is another contractual indemnity case. And that's all this is about. We have another case involving a question of whether a negligent would-be indemnity is to be indemnified under the agreement existing between the parties. If the contractual indemnity provision in the drilling contract involved in this case is not enforceable to grant indemnity to the negligent party, my client should win and this court should reverse and render. If the contractual indemnity provision involved here is enforceable to some degree, but limited to a dollar amount set out in former Article 2212B of the revised civil statutes, my client should win because my client has already paid far more than that amount under an agreement between the parties in settling with the injured person, the agreement which allows either party to get its money back if it prevails here. Only if the contractual indemnity provisions involved in this case are held to be enforceable to indemnify the negligent party without limit, should this court affirm. One of the issues upon which the court granted writ of error involved conflicts of laws. I intend to touch on that first. The case of Duncan versus Cessna by this court in 1984 held that the law of the state with the most significant relationship to the particular substantive issue before the court would be applied to resolve that issue. The court also held that the choice of law should be based upon the qualitative nature of the state's contacts with the issues before the court and the contacts which implicate a state's public policy on the issue before the court are important in reaching that decision. Why have I emphasized how the respondent describes this case? Because it is only when respondent speaks of conflicts of laws that it talks about other kinds of obligations not involved in this case. For example, the obligation to drill a well in Kansas, that's not involved in this case. The fact that the rig in question was located in Kansas, that's not involved in this case. The fact that the injured party had his injuries occur in Kansas, he's not involved in this case. He was a citizen of Oklahoma. His lawsuit was in Kansas. Only when that point isn't under discussion, that is conflicts of laws, do they admit that this is a contractual indemnity provision case? Mr. Boydston, who was injured and whose injury started this whole thing, was an employee of a casing contractor contracted by my client. He was injured by respondent's negligence. My client was not negligent. There is no question about that. The would-be indemnity was the negligent party. Duncan spoke of public policy. Public policy in this area involving the issue before this court has been announced a number of times by two bodies. First of all, this court in the case of Ethel Corporation versus Daniel Construction Company, in which you said, as we have moved closer to the express negligence doctrine, the scriveners of indemnity agreements have devised novel ways of writing provisions which fail to expressly state the true intent of those provisions. The intent of the scriveners is to indemnify the indemnitee for its negligence, yet be just ambiguous enough to conceal that intent from the indemnitor. The result has been a plethora of lawsuits to construe those ambiguous contracts We hold the better policy is to cut through the ambiguity of those provisions and adopt the express negligence doctrine.
Counsel, what is the public policy inherent in the legislature adopting section 127.002?
The legislature says it finds that inequity is fostered on certain contractors by the indemnity provisions in some agreements pertaining to wells for oil and gas, and that certain agreements that provide for indemnification of a negligent indemnity are against the public policy of the state. And I guess that's all I know about that, Judge, except I will say the cases that the court can see show that probably nowhere more than in the oil and gas industry have contractors tried to make other people liable for their own negligence.
The IADC, which has 2,170 corporate members, is this a standard contract used throughout the industry?
Yes. That's a bunch of drilling contractors. That's the Respondents Association. And that's the kind of contract that was signed in this case on an IADC standard form contract. I've given you two statements of public policy by this court and by the legislature. What were the Texas contacts? Both parties are Texas residents, both Texas corporations. All contracts were signed in Texas. All money, which is what this suit is about, money between them, was expressly made payable in Texas. Most of the contracts, the drilling contracts between these parties over the years, were totally performable in Texas, but this one happened to have the well drilled in Kansas. Kansas has no interest in the contractual indemnity provisions involved here. There were no Kansas residents involved, no suit involving this issue in Kansas. The injured party who sued in Kansas has been paid and has no interest. I submit that the law of Texas should apply under Duncan. There are two reasons why the indemnity agreement in this case is not enforceable. First, article, what used to be 2212B, that I just read the public policy from, is now chapter 127 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, voids such contracts to the extent that they attempt to indemnify the negligent party. And secondly, the express negligence rule adopted by unanimous decision of this court in Ethel makes these provisions in this case unenforceable. One of the points the court granted the writ on had to do with the statute, I will cover that first. The statute in question makes void such contracts as this. Starts out by making them void insofar as they attempt to indemnify the negligent party. There'll be no question about, is this the kind of contract that the statute speaks of? It is. Next, there are some exclusions in the statute which are not applicable to this case. Neither of us will claim that. Next is a paragraph, a section which says insurance coverage. And it provides that this chapter does not apply. That is, this chapter voiding these contracts does not apply if the parties agree in writing that the indemnity obligation will be supported by available liability insurance coverage to be furnished by the indemnitor. Now, the Appendix B to our application for writ of error contains the contractual indemnity language involved. Let me just say that. The statute says if the parties agree in writing that the indemnity obligation will be supported by, this contract does have language which says the indemnity provision will be so supported by that insurance coverage, and then here's the kicker, or voluntarily self-insured in part or in whole. Now, I think that's because the drilling contractors didn't want to try to make the operators buy insurance. There's nowhere else in that contract that they attempt to make the operator buy any insurance. The operator makes the drilling contractor buy insurance, and it states how the dollar amount, the only dollar amount in that contract of insurance, says that the drilling contractor will provide $100,000 worth of liability insurance. That's the respondent in this case. This reminds, I can't help telling the story, this reminds me of an old fellow out at Vega where I grew up. The story goes that he had a dog he was very proud of, and he was demonstrating to a visitor how disciplined the dog was. And he said, "Roll over," and the dog just looked at him. And he said a little louder, "Roll over," and the dog just sat there. And finally he shouted at the dog, "Roll over," and the dog scared and went over and crawled under the bed. And he said, "Or else go over there and crawl under the bed." Now the visitor probably noted that those two commands were inconsistent. I tell you that the command that the statute says that we have to, for the exception to the statute to prevail, my client has to have agreed in writing to provide available liability insurance coverage is totally inconsistent with the next words, "or voluntarily self-insured in part or in whole." I submit to the court that unless you happen to own an insurance company, self-insured means you're not insured. And that is the opposite of agreeing in writing to provide insurance coverage. The next provision of the statute says the indemnity obligation is limited to the extent of coverage and dollar limits of insurance the indemnitor has agreed to furnish. There are no dollar limits that my client ever agreed to furnish, either of insurance or of no insurance. And last, the amount of insurance required, and this has to do with the particular point, one of the points upon which the writ was granted, the amount of insurance required may not exceed $300,000. Now, that's not what it says, but Mr. Powell and I will both agree that's what it means. It really says 12 times the state's basic limits and so forth. So it means $300,000. So the amount of insurance required, if we'd been required to furnish any, couldn't have exceeded $300,000. Now the facts in this case are my client had a $1 million policy with a $1 million deductible. That sounds a little like no insurance for the first $1 million. And my client paid, not an insurance company, that first $1 million. We paid about $2.5 million, and we split it under this agreement, and then we're in here fighting about which one of us has to pay it. There was some excess coverage, and then my client paid 30% of that, 70% on it. But the first $1 million was no insurance, I say. I said there were two reasons why the indemnity is not enforceable. The other is the express negligence rule. This court has not upheld a contractual indemnity for a negligent indemnity since Ethel unless the actual words of the contract provided for indemnity for a negligent indemnity. Oh, let me give quick and not too much emphasis to the fact that this statute was amended in 1989. It purports to cover everything that ever went on before it. The amendment itself occurred while this case was on appeal, but I don't want to give it too much dignity by saying that it's unconstitutional, which it is to that extent because it's retroactive and we've cited cases like that, but it doesn't matter anyhow. It's a very badly done statute, and it looks to me like much drilling contractors got to the legislature, because in this case, they were talking about mutual indemnities, and that's, somehow that's different. There's no case authority for saying mutual indemnities. If two parties agree to indemnify one another, that's different. Ethel didn't say that. Nobody else said that. But this statute comes up with these same magic words and has a definition of mutual indemnity. And the definition, by the way, doesn't fit our case at all, and we tell you that in our supplemental brief. But the point is that only is applicable in this limitation of liability section. The two sections that are really involved here are, number one, everything's void. Number two, there is an exception if the parties agree in writing that we will provide insurance, and we didn't. And so this really is immaterial. Back to the express negligence rule. This case has a typical indemnity down to a certain point. By the way, there are a bunch of cases. There's been an Eastern District federal case involving the same language There have been two other Court of Appeals cases involving the same language, and both of them held the same way the court did in this case. Both of them been settled, and the writs dismissed. So this is your first chance to look at this, but there are a lot of contracts out there with this same language. Same old thing, all claims of every kind and nature and so forth, rising in connection herewith, and then here's the different language. Without limit, and without regard to the cause or causes thereof, I'm still quoting, or the negligence of any party or parties. Now, the closest language I've seen to this, and not be this, was a case of the Fifth Circuit back in 1975, entitled, it's a Chevron case, Chevron Company versus E.D. Walton Construction Company. In that case, they had same old all-inclusive, non-specific indemnity language. And then they had this language, including without limitation and irrespective of negligence. Chevron said that's close. And, of course, the court at that time was applying the clear and unequivocal rule. The court went ahead to say, relying on this court's earlier holdings that were awful close to express negligence rule in the state of Texas. And then the court went into this. What does this mean, irrespective of negligence? Walton claims the agreement between Chevron and Walton fails to pass the Texas clear and unequivocal test because it does not specify to whom the phrase, quote, irrespective of negligence, refers. And the court is saying this. Does it mean, one, Walton will indemnify Chevron irrespective of negligence on Walton's part absent Chevron's negligence, or two, that Walton will indemnify Chevron where Walton is negligent irrespective of Chevron's concurrent negligence, or three, that Walton will indemnify Chevron irrespective of Chevron's sole negligence being the proximate cause of the injury? And the court said there are several possibilities there, and that's certainly not clear and unequivocal. Well, how does that compare with the language of this case? Is without regard to the negligence, which is in our contract, the same any clearer than irrespective of negligence? I submit not. Does adding the words of any party or parties? Well, if it didn't have that, would we be talking about negligence of horses or dogs? The Chevron case, the Fifth Circuit in the Chevron case, specifically referred to just the two parties involved and didn't assume that it was talking about anybody else, and still found three different possibilities in that vague language, irrespective of negligence. And I don't think saying without regard to the negligence of any party, either party, any, it didn't say either, it said any party, that gets us anywhere.
Counsel, is there anything in the record that shows why your client signed such a contract?
No more than there is on why Daniel Construction Company did in the Ethel case, Judge. I don't think either one of them, as far as I know, I think they were stupid. But it is pretty vague, and it's in a printed contract, and it does say that you have a right to either insure it or not insure it. My client may have been familiar with the statute and know that this is void if we weren't required to insure it by the contract. We obviously weren't. My client may have known that it didn't pass the clear and unequivocal test, which was then in force. I don't know, Judge. There's no evidence in it. This is a summary judgment case. Both of us moved for summary judgment on the contract itself and stipulations mostly. And so far it's been successful for him. Thank you.
Any questions? The court is ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael E. Powell, to present argument for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I do represent Moran Brothers, the drilling contractor here. Let me speak to one thing that Justice Cook did bring up. This contract, these clauses, there is evidence in the record that these clauses are used not only in the IADC standard forms, but also the American Petroleum Institute standard forms. These clauses that are before the court are the standard clauses, as there is evidence in the record to support, that are used throughout the United States in drilling contracts offshore and onshore. Let me speak.
Was the statute passed to avoid that part of the contract?
I don't think it was, Your Honor, because the statute was passed. Let me speak just a minute to these clauses. It takes a minute to examine these clauses, but when one does, and when one looks at some of the, especially U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit cases that have dwelled on these clauses, these are mutual or reciprocal indemnity clauses. I think the purpose of the statute was to prevent overreaching bargaining situations that weren't equal, unfair. When one contracting party says to the other, I will indemnify you for this, and in exchange you indemnify me for the same thing. I mean, there are mirror image indemnities. The purpose of the clauses, as the Fifth Circuit has explained, and we've quoted some of that language in our brief, was to basically say that the people who come to work at this well drilling site, which is like a construction site, you bring all kinds of trades there and there's a lot of activity and everybody's trying to get the job done. People who, the contractor is there, in this case the oil company, Shamrock, and then the drilling contractor comes there, they're going to be responsible for injuries to the persons they bring to the job site. And as the Fifth Circuit's pointed out, that says you can, then that makes you responsible for making sure you have competent people, that they're trained for safety. You can decide who's going to buy the insurance and make sure everybody's covered. You can allocate the costs of that insurance into the job. If you have an accident, you don't spend all your time fooling around with who's at fault or whose negligence it was. We know who's responsible by who brought the person to the job site. That person's responsible for medical care, and that person's responsible for the injuries. It's a rational way of dealing with this kind of problem, and I think that it's rational is shown that it exists throughout the oil field, and it's signed not only by drilling contractors, of which there aren't very many these days, but big oil companies like Diamond Shamrock, now Maxis, and these other big oil companies. So these are clauses that really have met the test of time, and they do specifically fit into the exception in old Article 2212B that says, in effect, we're not writing a statute here to protect insurance companies, and we're not writing a statute that tells people they can't go out and hire an insurance company to bear a risk, which is what insurance companies are in the business of doing. And if you agree in writing that your indemnity obligation is going to be supported by liability insurance coverage, then this statute doesn't apply. There is no intent on the face of this statute to make it impossible for people to buy insurance or to discourage the purchase of insurance.
But counsel, didn't it do this? Didn't it say to that small guy who wants the job, it says, you either buy all the insurance that we require you to buy, or you don't get the job.
Well, I think that's what subsection, the proviso that's in now subsection C of the insurance proviso says. It says you can't require more than $300,000 worth of insurance. I think that's what that says. It said that, I think, is a precondition to contracting thing. It says you cannot require, if you're the owner, Shamrock in this case, they're the ones who are going to be advertising for bids for drilling contractors. And they cannot, under this statute, say as a precondition to bidding or as a precondition to contract, you must buy more than $300,000 worth of insurance. That didn't happen in this case. That's not what is at issue here, and I think that's a point that we need to spend some time on, because that is one point that the court did grant its writ on. Let me speak first, if I might, because I think this is an important question, to the application of Kansas law. I think this case presents a choice of law question, which this court, I think, should look at. This case is a classic example, this contract is a classic example of a contract made in one jurisdiction to perform services in another jurisdiction. Mr. Sprouse did tally up the contacts. I mean, this contract was to drill a well in Kansas. The well was drilled in Kansas. This was not a rig that was sent from Texas to Kansas. I mean, this is a rig that was in Kansas, and it stayed in Kansas after this well was drilled. The contacts are clearly weighted toward Kansas. The only things that exist in Texas are that the companies had their headquarters here, and that, in fact, the contract appears to have been signed here, although there's no direct evidence of that, but nobody really has any evidence that it was signed anywhere else. It looks like it was done by mail between Wichita Falls and Amarillo. All of the governing law, whether one looks to the restatement, which this court has adopted as being the governing principle of contracts, of conflict resolution in contract cases, or if you look at the other law, the law that existed before the restatement, all of that law says that where you have a contract to perform services in some other jurisdiction, you apply the law of that jurisdiction. This court held that in the Castillejo case not very long ago. I mean, it's been since 67, but it's not an ancient case. It's a case that predated Duncan. But the restatement of contracts specifically says, it has a specific provision, a separate rule, that's referred to in the general parts of the restatement, but then it's called out specifically, restatement section 196. Contracts for the performance of services will be governed by the law of the place where the services are to be performed, regardless of where the contracts happen to be made. And the comment goes on to say that that's true even as to incidental aspects of the contract, because if you're going to go into Kansas and you're going to drill a well, and you're going to bring all these people and all these products and goods and services in here, and we're going to drill a hole in Kansas ground, Kansas definitely has an interest in all of the attributes of that transaction. The restatement specifically says, in that situation, that all of the contract is more likely governed by Kansas law. Now, what I want to go on, though, beyond what the decisional law and the restatement would dictate, it seems to me, that the court do with respect to the conflicts question, and point out some other things that I think are very powerful on the conflicts of law issue. Now, the reason I argue for Kansas law, obviously, is that that gets the court out of the thicket of what Article 2212B says.
Yes, let me just interrupt you before you move on to another point. If the injured individual has already been paid, and it's just a fight here as to who's going to bear the ultimate loss, the individual hasn't been made whole, who cares? I mean, what issue does Kansas have as to who pays?
Well, it seems to me, Your Honor, Kansas has an interest in making sure injured individuals up there are compensated, and this whole system that we're talking about here was the procedure that these parties put into place to make sure.
But the individual has been made whole.
This individual has been made whole by a settlement that turns really on this deal. This case is the reason why that individual has been made whole by settlement.
My point is, what interest does Kansas have as to who ultimately bears the loss? An accident happened in Kansas that made whole.
I don't know. You know, if you get down to that level of analysis, does Kansas care about what happens here today? I don't know that I could say Kansas cares about that. But it seems to me that the question is, does Kansas care about the enforcement of a contract such as this in the drilling of a well in Kansas? And since what we're talking about here are the provisions that these parties crafted to make sure that people who are injured are made whole, it seems to me Kansas has an interest in enforcing those provisions, because otherwise great gaps could be torn in the provisions that exist in Kansas, not for this guy. He's already hurt, he's already doctored, and he's already compensated, but as a general matter for these types of contracts. But let me answer that by going further to my second point, because I think it's very powerful on the choice of law issue. And that is, if you look at this contract, we put the contract, it's attached as an exhibit, appendix to our brief, which is the red brief. If you look at the contract, and as we've discussed, the contract really has a very comprehensive set of mutual indemnities. And the contract also has an insurance provision, which I think is separate and apart from that set of indemnities. But in the contract, the parties tied both of those provisions, not by saying Kansas law shall apply, but impliedly by what they said in those provisions. They tied them to the law of the place where the well was to be drilled. Look at the indemnity clauses. One of the types of persons who is indemnified is an invitee. Well, how does one determine who an invitee on Kansas land is by reference to any law other than the law of Kansas? The restatement says that the parties, the court may, by examining the contract, ascertain that the parties intended for the law of a particular jurisdiction to apply. Seems to me that this is a clear situation where I say I'm going to determine who is responsible for indemnifying a person by deciding whether that person is an invitee or a trespasser or a licensee. One impliedly says I'm going to determine this, the scope of this very clause, by the law of the place where the land is located, because that's how you determine who an invitee is. That's a concept that pertains to land and the duties of occupiers of land, the persons who come on the land, and that has to be a very local concept. In the insurance clause, the contract requires that the parties, that we obtain insurance from a company authorized, licensed to do business in the state where the well's to be drilled. So that clause is also tied.
Counsel, let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
I've seen a lot of indemnity agreements where, for instance, I agree to indemnify you for my negligence, and you agree to indemnify me for your negligence. Cross indemnification. You've pointed out how widely this is used by the American Petroleum Institute and also all the drilling contracts. But it's different. It says, I agree to indemnify you for your negligence, and you agree to indemnify me for my negligence. It seems like it's encouraging the other side to be negligent.
Well, it really doesn't say that, Your Honor. What it says is, I agree to indemnify you against any harm to my employees, or my contractors or their employees, regardless of whose negligence causes the harm.
But it's cross-indemnification.
That's right.
And here, there's no doubt that the petitioner was not negligent at all, yet they're being asked to pay for the whole thing.
They contracted to do that, and we contracted...
What is the logic behind agreeing to indemnify someone? Or it appears as if you're encouraging the other side to be negligent.
Well, I don't think you are. You are saying, in a way, it's almost a no-fault allocation of risk. We're businessmen. We're going to go out there and we're going to drill this well. Let's decide who's going to be responsible for my people, and you be responsible for your people. I mean, the Fifth Circuit has described that very carefully and said, I'm going to be responsible for my people. I'm going to discourage unsafe operations. I'm going to buy insurance to cover it, and you do the same.
But you're not responsible for your people. Your people were responsible for the accident that they're having to pay for.
No, I'm responsible if my people were hurt. It's one of his people who was hurt. I'm saying that it doesn't turn on, they don't allocate responsibility by fault. I mean, that's right. They don't in this situation. They allocate responsibility by who brought the person to the job site and who's responsible and who can get the insurance. Now, I don't think it encourages anybody to be negligent.
If we accept the opinion of the CA, are we not in effect gutting the statute?
No. No, you're not, because the statute has the insurance exception, and that's what the Court of Appeals said. This case is within the insurance exception.
Well, it looks like to me, though, that if I'm to get the job, I not only got to cover what happens through my own employees, but I've got to cover what happens through your employees.
Well,
so I get to bear the whole burden, my employees and your
employees. No. My employees I'm responsible for, and you're not responsible for. And you, for your employees, you're responsible. You're responsible for the people
you indemnify if one of your employees does something.
No. You have to indemnify me if one of my employees is harmed. I mean, if one of your employees is harmed. That's what happens.
When you enter into your contract, do you examine each other's insurance coverage?
I don't know, Your Honor, what they do with that. We've got two great big companies here.
The contract provides the certain levels and types of coverage.
It does not. With respect to the indemnity clause, and I think that's a point I need to address, there is an insurance paragraph in the contract, paragraph 13. It sets out four different kinds of insurance that my client is required to buy. It sets out workers' comp insurance, and it sets out comprehensive public liability insurance for injuries, comprehensive public liability insurance for damages, and automobile liability insurance. That's not the type of insurance we're talking about here. None of those fit. What we're talking about with respect to the indemnity clause is contractual liability insurance, which is different. So there, we are required to buy certain types of insurance. My side is. Their side was not.
You're required to cover your employees' personal injury.
we're required to have workers' comprehensive public liability. That's to our, I mean, that adheres to our benefit only. Absent another policy or an endorsement of some kind, it does not cover contractual obligations we take on.
And you just assume then that the other party has the same type of insurance?
Both parties agree in the contract to obtain that insurance for the other.
Is there a provision in the policy that says the other party will furnish you within X number of days a copy of the policy?
There is with respect to those four types of insurance I mentioned, but there is not with respect to the contractual liability insurance. But both parties do agree to support their indemnity obligation with insurance, just in the language of the statute.
But to furnish you a policy, a copy of the policy, or the binder with an
extra. It does not say that. I don't know. These two parties have done business for, you know, there are many contracts in the record.
But this case has far-reaching consequences.
It has far-reaching consequences. And it seems to me that, you know, it requires it. Let's talk about the express negligence argument that Mr. Sprouse made. There have been two other courts of appeals besides the Dallas court in this case examine those clauses and find that they meet the express negligence test. The federal court has done the same.
Were those clauses identical to the one in this case?
Yes, they are.
How about McGuffin and Corpus Christi?
McGuffin went that way. McGuffin said these meet the express negligence test. These very clauses, these are standard clauses. The case that Mr. Sprouse talks about in his brief, the Chevron versus Walton case, is an old Fifth Circuit case. Interestingly, he doesn't tell you about the Thiro case, T-H-I-R-O-T case, which we cited in our brief, which came along after Chevron versus Walton, and the Fifth Circuit examining these clauses said, well, these clauses don't have the defects we talked about in Walton, and these clauses meet the test. So the Fifth Circuit has even moved beyond the case that he talked about with respect to these particular clauses. It seems to me that one other comment on choice of law, and that is that, you know, if the court's on the fence on the choice of law issue, it seems to me that there's an important principle, and that is what the parties did sign this contract. The parties did go out and buy a lot of insurance. Shamrock has $6 million of insurance that they have admitted covers this claim and is available. They've admitted that if this judgment is enforced, it will be paid 70% by Lloyd's of London. The insurance is there. And that's another important fact, it seems to me, in this case, and that is we're not talking about a hypothetical situation where somebody was supposed to buy insurance and didn't. We have insurance here to cover this entire claim. And that statute should not be interpreted, it seems to me, to protect insurance companies. So on what public policy is there for saying insurance companies got the premium, wrote the policy, covered the risk, it happened. The policy's there, the coverage is there, but for some public policy reason, we're going to say they don't have to pay.
Counsel, let me see if I understand your argument. You're contending that this Court of Appeals opinion is not in conflict with McGuffin?
That's correct. I don't think it's in conflict with McGuffin. It's certainly not in conflict with McGuffin on the express negligence case, because those two courts come out exactly the same way on the express negligence case. Now, there has been some talk.
You're familiar with that Texas Bar article?
I'm familiar with the Bar Journal article. They say it's in conflict with McGuffin on the $300,000 limit. Now, it's not, because that was never an issue in McGuffin. That particular section, I still think in terms of 2212B, but in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, the insurance provision, and I'll have to get it out here, but whatever section of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code that is, it's section 127.005, where the potential conflict with maybe I'm out of time, but let me answer your question.
Go ahead and finish your answer.
Where the potential conflict with McGuffin pertains to section 127.005C of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and that is whether there's a meaning to the word required to purchase more than $300,000 worth of insurance. Court of Appeals in this case said Shamrock was not required. They specifically stipulated in the contract that they were voluntarily providing lots of insurance. And they did, in fact, provide lots of insurance. So we don't have a situation here. Shamrock hasn't come in to say that there was a unfair bargaining situation that they have not said that they did anything other than voluntarily do what the contract says they did. McGuffin said that the recovery of ARCO in that case was limited to $300,000. However, in that case, ARCO had never even asked for more than $300,000, and there was no showing in the contract whatsoever that McGuffin, who was the drilling contractor in my situation in that case, had more than $300,000 worth of insurance. So the issue that this Court of Appeals, in my case, had to address was not even present in McGuffin. So I don't think there's a conflict between those two at all. It was just not breached in McGuffin. We appreciate the time of the Court, and we would ask the Court to affirm the Dallas Court's opinion and the opinion of the trial judge in this case. Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Thank you, Ken. Let me just ask one. Are you familiar with the Petroleum Equipment Suppliers Association newsletter?
No, I'm not.
Okay, because it suggests that there's a conflict between the two cases also, and that the way to circumvent the statute is to do, you know, is to rely on Mathis.
Well, there, if the Court examines those two opinions carefully, there is no conflict, because this issue, it's just a recitation in McGuffin that ARCO has said it's only seeking $300,000 and McGuffin only has $300,000 worth of insurance. So they didn't even need to go into the question of whether it is absolutely barred, as Maxis would contend in this case, for anybody to contract for more than $300,000 worth of insurance, which seems to me to be sort of a ridiculous thing, because, you know, you've got everything from water wells to drilling of mine shafts covered by the statute. $300,000 may be appropriate in some cases and not in others, and people ought to be free to negotiate that situation. But I don't think there's a conflict between the government, and there's certainly not on the express negligence rule, because both courts held the same, as well as the Adams Resources case from Houston. Thank you very much.
One thing I neglected to mention in this express negligence area is that the federal case, this court hasn't had before at these particular provisions before, but the federal case that I mentioned, DuPont versus TXO Production Company, has been mentioned by this court in a footnote in the Atlantic Richfield case, and the footnote says as follows: compare DuPont versus TXO Production Company, where the court held that the indemnity provision fulfilled the express negligence test. However, we do not necessarily agree with that holding. The provisions there were the same as the provisions here. One of these cases, the Adams case, I believe, had involved a drilling contract, but the statute was never brought up. It only dealt with the express negligence rule and dealt wrongly with it. I think it cited DuPont, which is the case that this court has questioned the holding in. Both parties, Mr. Powell mentioned that both parties had agreed to furnish insurance. Well, of course, that's a pretty big question here. The only express requirement on either party to furnish insurance is in the insurance provision of the contract, paragraph 13, which requires the respondent to furnish four different kinds of insurance. And if we're required to furnish insurance, which is what the statute requires as an exception to it, not that you have insurance, but that you agree in writing to furnish it. That happens to be what the legislature felt ought to create an exception. And the question is not whether you have it or not, although I insist that for the first $1 million, we didn't have it. But that's not what the statute deals with. The statute deals with, did you require it? And the question is, did the old-timer require that dog to get over there under the bed? And he didn't. He said, do one or the other. Maybe I should say, did he require him to roll over? He required him to do that, but that's not what he did. The statute involved here is trying to do exactly what the drilling contractors and Chevron and ARCO and a lot of other companies are trying to get around. That is, they're trying to shift the burden of these injuries from the guilty party to the innocent party. This court has said in Ethel that you can do that, but you have to spell it out. There's just no spelling it out in this case. The legislature has said, though, that in cases involving oil and gas wells, you can't do it unless you require in writing that the other party provide insurance, and then I submit you can only do it to the tune of $300,000, which is what was said in McGuffin. I agree that does not seem to have been the point of McGuffin. It doesn't seem to have, the opinion does not show whether that was an issue or not. But it does say that in any event, it would be limited to $300,000. Well, we've already paid well over $1 million, and we got a judgment against us for another $1.5 million or $1.75 million. And we didn't have any insurance on the first million.
Do you agree with your opposing counsel that in this case does not conflict with McGuffin?
Well, I think it conflicts with what McGuffin says.
But the issue was not before it. Say, so there.
I don't know. It does say that the other side stipulated that it's not, or agreed with that. But it does say that in any event, the statute limits it to $300,000. I don't know exactly what that means, Connor, but it certainly conflicts with what happened in McGuffin. They limited it to $300,000.
If you sent the contract back, that I object to the language because of the statute, please change the language in this pre-printed form. Is that a negotiable item?
Oh, I think it would be, yes. There are all kinds of strikeouts and changes here, and I think probably would be. I think if they had required insurance, then up to $300,000, the statute may have been accepted, may have been enforceable, for example. If they had set out, If we're going to indemnify you, even if you're the one.
On the $300,000, you bid a job and you say out there that all bidders must furnish insurance in the sum of $1 million.
Judge Ray, I don't believe under this statute, if it's an oil and gas well contract that we're talking about, like a drilling contract, I don't believe you can do it with that statute. I think the legislature has said just what it said. That's against the public policy of this state. And that's just like a gambling contract. You can't do it. It lets somebody off for his own negligence. It shifts the burden.
So you can only require $300,000, you've got to carry yourself.
There is one other place. That Texaco filed a brief this Monday. And they're talking about another issue, and I agree with them. That's another issue. And that is, can you make me include you as an insured in my policy? As far as I know, you can do that. I gave a paper to the Advanced Oil and Gas Law Seminar and said, I think you can do that. But that's not what happened. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. That concludes the business of the court for the day, and the marshal will adjourn.
The audience will leave, right? Oye, oye, oye. Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.